Hey y'all, it's Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. I'm a board-certified gynecologist, a clinical assistant professor of OBGYN at Northwestern Feinberg School of Medicine, and owner of a private practice for almost a decade that specializes in menopause and sexual medicine. I'm a South Asian American Muslim woman who is here to empower, educate, and help you advocate for health issues that have been stigmatized, shamed, and perhaps even prevented you from living your best life. I'm better than your best girlfriend and more open than most of your doctors. I'm here to educate so you can advocate. Welcome to Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Let's go. Hey, y'all. It's me, Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. Welcome back to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I'm a sex med gynecologist and menopause specialist in Chicago, and I am doing stuff that you guys will be interested in. I am actually transforming my practice soon. I'm joining the Miss Medicine Network of Clinicians, and I am working on a book that I'll tell you about once I have the cover. But I'll keep you posted. So today I just spoke to another Ishwish pal. Okay, I just bring on Ishwish people. Fine, sue me. Now, and another Ishwish pal of mine who is pretty cool. He just wrote a book that I wanted him to talk about. His name's Corey Babb. He's a gynecologist, and he is a Tulsa native who has dedicated his life to bringing awareness and acceptance to female sexual health. Through education, activism, and empathy, he helps people feel heard and validated, empowering them to find answers in a complicated medical environment. In addition to being a board-certified gynecologist, he is an international fellow for Ishwish, and he is a Menopause Society-certified physician and a member of ISSVD. That's where I know him, because we're part of the same organizations here. He is trained by Peter Pasek in the Pasek Multimillion Botox Program under anesthesia, and it is really a revolutionary treatment that we talk about. I do it in my office. I actually had Dr. Pasek, when he retired, discussed it with him and got his information, and he helped me walk through my first case years ago. He serves as a board of Ishwish and is a reviewer for multiple sexual medicine journals, lecturer, educator. He does it all, and he's pretty cool. So he likes to call himself the Mr. Rogers of the sexual medicine community. So it's a beautiful day in the neighborhood. Let's talk to Dr. Corey Babb. So take a listen to this. It's a quick one. We just talked a little bit about his book and about vaginismus and other things about being a man in gynecology. So let's get at it. Today I have a very special guest, a good friend of mine from Ishwish, that you heard the introduction, and we're going to get at it with Dr. Corey Babb. You didn't think I'd do that either.
I didn't think,
good as the first one.
it's still really good. Still really good.
Hey, Corey, so excited to have you here. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So we both practice sexual medicine and menopause care. You guys will read in the notes, you know, and for my introduction, you know that Dr. Babb's over at the Haven Center. And we both know the trials and tribulations of learning how to do sexual medicine and how it comes about. So Corey decided to fix it. So Corey, tell us how you decided to fix sexual medicine for people specifically clinicians who are looking to get help for sexual medicine needs. And, you know, tell us what you did.
Yeah. So I kind of took the knowledge that was out there and condensed it into a book called The Practical Guide for Female Sexual Medicine. And like you said, it is directed towards clinicians, although I tried to make it so that, you know, anyone could understand it. But basically, it takes kind of the discipline and distills it down into, you know, overviews of anatomy, physiology, endocrinology with it, the domains of sexual dysfunction, different treatment modalities, diagnostic testing, different things kind of like that, to try and put it together so it can literally be I wonder what I should do with this patient with, you know, low desire. Oh, this patient's got vestibulitis. How do we treat that? And instead of going through a giant textbook and trying to flip through all the pages, you're like, boom, it's right there in that chapter. You can jump right to it.
Wonderful. And so it's a practical guide. And so I think that's what's mm-hmm. the key here, because I feel like a lot of times when you read textbooks, there is just a lot of maybe some research presented and probably, you know, some, you know, maybe nuance, maybe not as many nuances in actually how to treat patients. And although we know it's not truly like, you know, sexual medicine is not really algorithmic medicine, but there are things that we can do that's research based. And so I feel like that's really amazing that you did this. Is that sort of a, where you're at with this in terms of like how it came to be?
Yeah, pretty much. It really was kind of this desire to say, hey, we, you know, those of us that do this and do this kind of day in and day out, we know these things, but, you know, you treat patients a little bit differently than I treat patients, who treats different for a little bit, so and so, you know, and it trying to have kind of a central source where we can take what's out there from the research, but distill it down into an easily accessible way was really kind of the impetus for doing it.
That's great. And so you kind of talk about all the conditions that, you know, we treat mm-hmm. in this realm. So do you want to kind of go through some of the, like, just some of the big chapter topics?
Yeah. So it's basically divided into three different sections. So the first section is really a anatomy, physiology, endocrinology overview, and also kind of talking about the sexual medicine patient, like in a way to approach them. So talking about, you know, how are you doing informed consent with sexual medicine patients, like looking at things from a previous trauma standpoint, how to do specific types of exams like vulvoscopy or things like that. And the second portion really delves into the four domains of sexual function, you know, so desire, arousal, orgasm, and pain. And I break down the most common conditions in those area and kind of go through a, you know, each portion has a quick reference guide. So if you just wanted to flip to that and say, okay, this is how do you diagnose this? How is it treated? Kind of thing like that. Or it goes into a little more detail. And then the third section is a diagnosis and treatment specifically. So, you know, what lab tests could you run? What are you looking for with those lab tests? Or if you were to do imaging or use different, you know, sexual matrices like the FSFI or DSDS, how could you use those in clinical practice? There's a surgery section in there. Yeah, that's kind of the breakdown of the three main sections for it.
I love that. I think that's great because, you know, although I think there are, you know, there's one that was done through Ishwish mm-hmm. at some point, but, you know, to really make it more practical and more applicable, I think is great. And you know, people use multiple avenues sure. of learning things. So I think it's great. You know, tell everyone, I mean, I always love to hear the journey because we all have our journeys, how we entered into this area, right? Yeah. Like we were all delivering babies at one point and, well, not everyone, I guess some people were urologists or whatever, but like you and I were both delivering babies at one point and doing things. Like what brought you into this area of practice?
Well, so, and you know, I was kind of thinking about this just randomly recently, like what am I doing here? why am I doing this?
Well, we all do that. Like, yeah. What the hell am I doing?
Exactly.
Right now?
So, you know, when I went to college, I wanted to be a laryngologist. I want to do voice disorders. So my undergraduate degree is actually in music composition. And I was like, you know, I'm going to help people with, you know, if they have these, you know, singers and voice problems. And then I spent some time with a laryngologist and it was the most boring thing I've ever done in my life. No offense to them.
God bless those ENTs.
Yeah. You know, yeah. But so I went to med school and I was like, man, what am I going to do? And, you know, my whole family is women's health. My dad was an OBGYN. My mom worked in women's health. My sister was a labor and delivery nurse. She's now a hospice nurse. So kind of out of that. My wife has a master's in herbal medicine with a concentration in menopause and, you know, herbal therapies for that. So literally it is like, it's women's health everywhere in my family. And my dad was mostly an obstetrician. That's really what he loved to do. He loved delivering babies. And I kind of really liked more of the reproductive endo side of it. Like that was really mm-hmm. what I loved. And so I even thought about doing fellowship in REI, but then, you know, the infertility stuff just wasn't really super exciting. So,
right.
you know,
right.
get out into practice and start getting asked questions I have no idea how to answer because we weren't taught that.
Yeah.
And find Ishwish, and then that kind of starts the journey of going down that way. And then, you know, getting menopause certified with, you know, was NAMS at the time, and then doing stuff with the ISSVD for vulvar disease. And so
right.
here we are.
That's it. I mean, we have to learn through our own mechanism mm-hmm. after a while, because it's not, although we're changing that, right? We're slowly
right.
starting
That's
to change
right.
it a little bit, but it's not there yet. Well, that's great. And I know that one of your areas of interest specifically, and what as was mine, is vaginismus. Mm-hmm. So can we talk a little bit about some of the patient difficulties that you see with vaginismus, you know, who you're seeing, or pelvic, you know, this form of pelvic floor dysfunction, genital pelvic, you know, pain disorders. I think that, you know, we both see it in different ways. And, you know, I think we would share patients, but what do you see, the commonalities, you know, where do you go with treatment? Let's talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So, you know, I'm in Oklahoma, so we have a lot of Bible Belt kind of purity culture related vaginismus. I would say if there is one thing in this specific geographic area, my geographic patients that I see, that's kind of the main cause of it. Right. Yeah. And so, you know, we kind of, the thing that I am a huge fan, or actually kind of my vaginismus treatment journey, I happened to meet Peter Pasek at, you know, Aniswish, and actually like he had just retired, and I was like, oh, I know you're the Botox vaginismus guy. And he was like, you know, oh, I'll come out and teach you if you want. So I was on faculty at Oklahoma State at the time. And so we had like a grand rounds and everything and brought him out. So he taught me and how he did his stuff. And so that's kind of my main.
Yeah. He walked me through my first one.
Yeah. So he's an awesome guy. So.
Oh, that's awesome. And so let's talk about that, because I don't think I've ever really gone into detail about sort of the Peter Pasek model of treating vaginismus and why it's so important, especially with these patients. You know, we're speaking about the patients that, you know, more likely just, you know, they can't have any penetration. They've never had any penetration. They've never used tampons. They've never, it's been ingrained in them not to have, you know, any kind of anything in the vagina. So they come to us because they can't consummate relationships, marriages, whatever, or tolerate exams. And so what's your approach with them in terms of, and then tell us a little bit about the Dr. Pasek's model that we both use in our office.
So I think the first thing, you know, that really helps with these patients is giving them a name of what is going on, you know, and saying, hey, this is an actual thing. And I know there's some conflict, you know, if you look at the DSM, you know, is this, you know, GPPVD, vaginismus, like, is this a thing? And
I mean, it's such an old term, right? It's from like Sims days or whatever.
Right. But, you know, it's interesting, like, when you look at some of the newer data with it, you know, is there a difference, like, looking at actual, like, EMG readings of the, like, pubococcygeus model, you can see that there is something there, you know it, like, you can test it from that. And so, to me, at least, that's kind of the big thing to say, this is a separate entity.
Right. It's just not hypertone pelvis.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. So I think, like I said, kind of starting off with that, giving them a name to what's going on and kind of explaining why it happens is really helpful. And then with the Pasek model, you know, you're looking at doing a combination of Botox and then using vaginal dilators. And I mean, we have our patients, you know, they do the full, like, they're sleeping with a dilator in, you know, first 3 months, like, now varying degrees depending on which month they're in, and dilating more frequently during the day than when I talk to my, you know, pelvic floor PT colleagues. They're like, oh, they dilate for 15 minutes once a day. You know, we're having them dilate 2 hours in that first month, you know, every day. But for the patients that go through it, I mean, we have like I think our last kind of statistics, you know, around 95% cure rate for it, for the patients that actually do the whole thing.
Right. Exactly. And I think it's around the concept of, because most of these, your patients are also sedated or asleep for,
correct,
you know, for,
yep,
right.
Yep.
So, you know, I think that's distinguishing it from when you do it for high tone pelvis, you know, for vestibulodynia, for high tone pelvis. Mm-hmm. These are patients that can't tolerate anything.
Right.
And so we put them to sleep, and then, can you tell them a little about how we leave the dilators in and stuff?
Yeah. So, and that's kind of, I think, one of the things, you have someone who's never been able to tolerate penetration at all. And even the thought of having something internal can trigger that, you know, almost that hypervigilant state. And so you put them to, you know, conscious sedation, you go and you do the injections, and we start, you know, dilate them under anesthesia to make sure there's not any type of anatomical barrier that, you know, because some of these patients, they may, you know, they're, may have an imperforate hymen or something like that. I had a microperforate hymen.
Isn't that, that's always a surprise that I'm like, oh, it's imperforate. Well,
I had an Amish patient recently that, she had a microperforate hymen. And so, you know, then they wake up with the size 4 dilator, kind of the...
Because we also get into the mindset like, oh, this is purity culture again. So this is what it is. But then lo and behold, they have a congenital anomaly.
Yeah.
And so I've had a number of patients like that. And it's like, well, I mean, they're probably both, but this is a big obstructor right here.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, you're trying to, if they're like, well, I'll just push through it. It's like, sure. Tell, you know, we know that it's, you know, the pain associated with tearing those things is not anything that anyone wants to deal with. And so.
And sometimes they're right, really thick.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, they wake up with that dilator in place. And I think that's honestly my favorite thing with the whole procedure is when they wake up. And they're like, you're like, how are you doing? They're like, I'm fine. They're like, you have a dilator. And I'm like, I do. What are you talking about? And you're like, look, you can feel it. And they're like, what? And they take it out. They can put it back in. It doesn't hurt.
They take it out of me.
And they're like, what is going, you know, mind blown type thing. Yeah. That's, and that, that's awesome. I love it.
Yeah. I think he says it flips the switch in their brain, which I think he's always like, it's going to flip the switch. And so, but I think that's what it takes because I always, you know, we've always talked about how the absence of pain is not pleasure. And so for even for any of these patients who have been traumatized for so long with either like, you know, medical trauma or genital trauma, whatever, or just having these diagnoses that come to them that even when you fix their anatomical issue, do a vestibulectomy, you do a hymenectomy, you give them the Botox and you fix their physical problems. But there's this element that, you know, we don't tell patients it's in their head, but that's part of it. Like it's biopsychosocial, right?
Exactly. Well, and that's the other thing too. You know, you get them to where you're like, all right, hey, now you can have sex. Now we have to get you, or, you know, help with the want. You know, that's the other aspect of it too. So we always tell patients like, this is the first part of it. And some people dive right in afterwards and they're like, I'm having sex every day. You can't stop me. You know, it's been however long.
Yeah.
But then you have patients who are like, okay, I can do it. It doesn't hurt, but I still have that anxiety that it's going to hurt again. So I still have the avoidant behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then you have to retrain the brain as well as the pelvic floor, which is, I think that's even the most challenging for most patients, wouldn't you say? Especially the ones that go years and years without consummation. And so do you think there's one type of like, I guess, psych therapy that helps them more than others? Like, are you trying other things other than just like pure cognitive?
So EMDR and ART are the two main things I recommend for that. You know, if there is a specific trauma, I'll do EMDR mostly. If it's more of a generalized thing than ART, I do wonder a lot, and this is just kind of thinking out loud, about like TMS, you know, the transcortical magnetic, you know, stimulation. I think those are, that would be really interesting. Even ketamine therapy for some of these patients. But there's, you know, not any data on that for this. So
I think I've tried that with a couple of patients who I knew had some PTSD and then they really bad depression. There's only one patient I think it actually helped.
Nah, that's not it.
And then, you know, there's like the whole stellate ganglion block with patients that have PTSD.
Yeah.
I had been hopeful for like some PGAD patients that I had thought where I felt like it was coming from, you know, region 5 at some point. Uh-huh. I don't think it, and it's so complicated. I feel like when you're working on that region 5, the brain stuff gets too complicated to really say one.
You're almost like, trying to figure out like what, you know, is it a locus coeruleus thing? Like, is it a, you know, this hyperadrenergic, you know, aspect of like what all kind of, and I think that would be really interesting just, you know, to kind of think about. And I don't know if you're seeing more patients or, you know, that kind of are fitting into some of these dysautonomia type,
for sure,
you know, profiles. And, you know, they got this hyperadrenergic dysautonomia, this constant fight or flight all the time.
Yes.
You know, how do you calm that down? Mm-hmm. You know, and we see that with, you know, with sexual issues, with obviously pelvic floor, the correlation there with hypertonicity. You know, I think a brave new frontier for for what we do.
Yeah, we got to figure that, because it's just like that constant catastrophization that happens, right? Like, and it just feeds itself, like the whole thing, and that becomes very challenging. Mm-hmm. I think not only for the clinician, obviously the patient who experiences it, and it's just very overwhelming. Because I think we always talk about like we can fix the biology, we can fix the physical stuff sometimes. There's a lot of work. Sometimes I feel so bad telling patients how much they have. Like, you have to do the work. It's like, you know, but you do. You have to do some of the work to kind of.
Yeah, some people want the magic bullet. And it's like, well, you know, I wish there was one thing that could fix it all. But, you know, it's so multifactorial.
It's so multifactorial, this thing, yeah. What are you seeing a lot of in your office otherwise, other than the vaginismus? I know you probably see a lot of menopausal stuff happening right now.
Yeah. I mean, I would say the, you know, perimenopause, menopause stuff is super hot right now. So we see a lot of that. The other thing, I've had a couple, you know, more PGADs. They've kind of filtered in recently.
Yeah, I have one of those too, actually.
Yeah, but I mean, I'd say between probably our most common procedure that we do is, you know, Botox or pelvic floor dysfunction. So I'd say outside of the, you know, menopausal slash kind of hormone patients, that hypertonic pelvic floor stuff is the most common thing we probably see.
I was just telling someone, I'm like, well, I mean, if you're not clenching, I don't think you're paying attention with what's going on in the world. I feel everyone's clenching right now. The anxiety is 10 out of 10.
If you're not clenching, you're not paying attention. That's your t-shirt.
It's so true, though. Like, I just feel like, you know? And then you always ask, you clenching your jaw? Okay. Then the pelvis
got plantar fasciitis. Yep.
Yeah. So. Well, what's happening? What else are you going to be doing lately? What's next up on your frontier here?
So what I, like, you know, depending on how this book goes, I have this idea to do like a whole kind of practical guide series of thing kind of focused, you know, in more of these, I'll say niche areas. I don't think they should be niche areas. And they should be, you know, very, you know, lots of people have this stuff, but, you know, kind of that same format with, you know, menopause or vulvar disorders or things like that. That's kind of long-term thought. You know, at Haven Center, we're trying to figure out, like, okay, do we need to grow? You know, because right now it's me. You know, it's just me. I have an RN, and then I have my office manager and kind of my you know, front office person. And it's like we're kind of getting, you know, booked as much as we can see during the day. And we always try and have rooms we can work people in, but it's like, do we need to move? Do I need to get, you know, another provider? What type of stuff do I need to do for that?
Yeah, I think that's the thing. When your name gets out there and people start realizing that they can get help, and
then
what do you do with your practice? Because you've been solo now for how long?
We'll have been open for 3 years in October.
3 years. Oh, wonderful. And before that, what were you doing again?
So I did, I worked for Oklahoma State University for a good portion of time on clinical faculty there. And then I did some stuff with managed care, you know, just like local things, kind of the big healthcare groups. But that just did not speak to me. I liked academics a lot. I liked teaching a ton. But some of the politics with it gets to where...
I know, that's what I feel.
You can't, you know, do a lot of what you want to do. So it's like, well, this is it. I got to do my own thing.
All right. Because, then you just... I always say that the system really sets up us for failure in that respect. Right. Because it's like, you got to see 30 patients a day. You got to see these patients. And it's just not feasible with the kind of stuff that we diagnose and treat, I think.
No, not at all.
Yeah. And can you think of like a time where you felt like, you know, there's a patient that kind of woke up out of, who maybe wasn't advocating for themselves? Like, you know, because my big thing is like, we need to teach women how to advocate for themselves,
sure,
right?
Sure.
Like, and I feel like on some level, it's easy to discuss what's happening or maybe even to figure it out. But then like, when you're not getting the help that you need or not able to advocate for yourself, like, how do you sort of promote women taking control or advocating for themselves? Because I think both of us practice in a way that we are, you know, trying to give the best care we can in a shared decision-making fashion, right?
Sure. Really,
we're not practicing patriarchal medicine. But I feel like that's always the hard thing. Like, when patients go to different places and they're like, well, if I don't take, you know, well, how am I supposed to say this? Or what am I supposed to do? Or how am I supposed to do it? What are you helping?
No, I mean, I think, you know, what we do, kind of a mixture of, we do a lot of stuff with social media, obviously, you know, trying to, and just education. I think education is key to, you know, have patients kind of really take charge of their own health. They have to be able to know what's going on and not just kind of accept some of these very, you know, the platitudes. It's kind of like the, oh, sex hurts, you know, drink some wine. Mm. It's like, well, you know, that's not really going to fix anything. We actually had, though, you know, thinking about patients that really, like, after, you know, coming down, like, really did something, we actually had a patient start a nonprofit for women with gynecologic pain. It's called the Aziza Project.
Oh, yeah, I think I knew that. Yeah. Aziza, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so she came down to see us and, you know, was just like, I, you know, felt like, oh my gosh, I, you know, she was in Washington State. So she's like, you know, travel down to Oklahoma. Uh-huh. And she's like, there's got to be resources for people because there aren't a lot of us that do this, right. As you know, mm-hmm. you know, you're in Chicago, you got to, you know, kind of in that whole area of the country, you know, here in Oklahoma, it's like, I'm really the only one in Oklahoma mm-hmm. per se, you know, yeah. got colleagues in Dallas, you know, but even in Arkansas, there's not really many. Kansas City's not yeah. too, you know, so
yeah.
people have to travel. And so that's what kind of the big thing with the Aziza Project was, to have funding for people to be able to travel and see these specialists to get their you know, needs taken care of.
So if patients are having trouble, then, so you said the Aziza Project is something, who's, you guys are funding it or you're raising money for it?
No, the patient started it and basically, I mean, it just became a nonprofit, like did the whole nonprofit filing.
That's wonderful.
And
yeah. I think I follow her on social media. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Her name's Stephanie, but no, it's a great resource. I also think another really good one too is the whole lichen sclerosis support network.
Yeah.
You know, they are super active yep. with doing things and education and stuff like that too.
Mm-hmm. And tight-lipped for, you know, vulvar. Mm-hmm.
Yep, tight-lipped. Yep.
Stuff like that.
NVA, that's another good
yeah.
one too.
And I love that. Yeah, because they're actually trying to get some of the clinicians to actually teach the residents,
right.
OBGYN residents, which is really nice. Because I feel like that's still a part that we have to fix one lecture probably isn't going to fix it, but at least they're introduced to something that, like, you know, we never got, right? We weren't even, stay away from the clitoris. Don't, what's a vestibule, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, no, it's really interesting. You know, I gave two lectures at ACOOG, you know, the Osteopathic OBGYN Society, their annual meeting last month. And it was crazy that some of the people that came up, you know, this one guy came up afterwards. He's like, well, so I've been treating, you know, I see a lot of these lichen simplex sclerosis patients. And he's like, and you know, I don't think they need to be on long-term steroids. Like, I think they're just fine. You know, they don't have any symptoms. I tell them only use the stuff. And I'm like, well, I said this in a lecture. This is what the data says.
Yeah.
This is the stuff. He goes, but I mean, do you really believe that? Do you really think?
What, do we not believe data anymore?
Yeah, I was like, yes, I do.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's like, well, they're old. That's what he would say. He's like, they're like 80. A lot of these patients, they don't want to be use steroids every day. And it's like, that's not the concern. There's a big difference when giving someone, like, you know, methylprednisolone orally every day
right.
versus,
you
know, clobetasol, you know, twice a week for you know, maintenance dosing
right.
for LS or something. So it has to be done at the, you know, resident level, the med school level, and even then, and, you know, kind of national meetings
yes,
still.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, that's great. I think that's what we have to do, and we have to continue to mm-hmm. do it. And hopefully, because it's this generation that we are that didn't get it, right? So it's like we have to,
right.
they have to, like, which is why I think, like, this year the Menopause Society was sold out, and, you know, mm-hmm. Ishwish was, I think, sold out too. And so we had a lot of.
Yeah, it was like the most that it's had. So,
like, we had over 700 people to share it, mm-hmm. right? So, yeah. Well, I'm glad you're doing all the work. I'm glad you just wrote this book. I wanted everyone to hear about it so that the clinician, well, anybody that wants to get a practical guide to female sexual yeah. medicine could find it. So we'll put all the information in the show notes.
Great. Thank you.
And, yeah, I really appreciate you coming. I know you're tired from your.
I got little bags under my eyes. I'm all right. Yeah. You know.
But I love your Instagram too. You always post a lot of good stuff on there. So,
well, thank you. I try and be like Mr. Rogers for sexual medicine. It's my, like, you know, tagline. I usually have the cardigan on.
Yeah, you
know,
did.
So.
Actually, yep. you should start yep. changing your shoes and then, like,
that's true.
Yeah, or taking, like, off your cardigan, putting on the cardigan, like.
That's right. We'll do the whole thing.
Yeah. I think we're aging ourselves. People probably don't know who Mr. Rogers is.
Oh, which is sad.
You should have a little background music too, you know, like a little bit of
beautiful. I used to do that, like, with the tick, and then people were like, the music's too loud. And, like, I was like, it is literally on the lowest thing. But, you know,
yeah,
you can't
yeah.
please everyone. So
the trolls are out there though.
That's true. Yeah. That's I get the you know, why are you a guy in this field trolling all
the
time.
Let's talk a little bit about that. Like, I mean, do you still get stuff about, I mean, obviously, you know, gynecology used to be a very male dominated profession.
Right.
And so I think that like the shift happened, I don't know when, maybe 10, 20 years ago or something. That mm-hmm. more. Did you find that? Did you feel anything like when you were like, did you feel in the time of training that people didn't want to see you because you were male or?
We would see it occasionally.
I mean, because you're in the South area, I feel like.
Yeah. So like, it was interesting. My residency class, I mean, in my like actual class, there were four of us and like it was three guys and a girl, you know, so like it. So, but even when I was on faculty, you saw the shift from being very male dominated in the number of residents to being mostly female dominated. But, you know, I view this, it's, you're right. I don't have experiential knowledge. I can't tell you what it feels like to have a period. I can't tell you what it feels like to have endometriosis, you know, things like that. Like I can empathize. I can be sympathetic and say that stinks. I have felt pain. I've had cramping, you know, things like that before.
Yeah, right.
But it's kind of, you know, and it sounds so cliche, but it's like, you know, you don't have to have a heart attack to be a cardiologist or, you know, like have cancer to be an oncologist.
Yeah, exactly.
So I don't get it really much. And especially people calling the office now, they know like I'm the only one there, you know, and I'm a guy, obviously. It's really just on social media. It's usually TikTok and it's, you know, why you guy in, you know, with the girl part, you know, like it's poor grammar. Can we use it to educate about, you know, things? Right. So,
yeah. They'll say all sorts of stuff. Like, sometimes like, hey, shouldn't you get your hair done? Like, I'm like, that's what you're commenting.
Shouldn't you get your hair done? No one has commented on my hair. Maybe I'll go get my hair done.
Don't go rambling on. I remember that was like a big one of mine. You ramble too much. I'm like, just scroll on then, you know?
The joy of just having a conversation. I mean, most conversations rambling, you know.
Oh my God. Anyway, well, thank you for coming on to the show today. And we'll put all the stuff in the show notes. And Dr. Corey Babb is amazing. You know, if you want to get some help with any of these issues or, you know, want him to come talk to you at your location too, he's amazing. So we love having him with Ishwish and everything as well. So.
Well, thank you so much.
But thank you. My name is Dr. Smita Rahman. I'm Gyno Girl. Thanks for joining me on Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Remember, I'm here to educate so you can advocate for yourself. Please join me on my next episode.
If you have a second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear to get more information. My practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.